Hi, this is Jane Garvey. Thank you for downloading the Woman's Hour podcast from Monday, the 16th of April, 2018. On this programme, you can hear from Kathleen Turner, Hollywood legend, now touring Britain with her cabaret show, and she gives good interviews. So Kathleen Turner on the programme today. Also, we discuss your online personality. Now, some of you will be completely on board with this and completely getting it. Others will be thinking, what are you going on about? But this is quite an interesting conversation between really two young women about how their online personas took over and actually became something of a burden. So that's in this podcast as well. But we started with an interview with Kat Colvin. Now, Kat Colvin is the sister of the great Sunday Times journalist, war reporter Marie Colvin. And it is sometimes easy to forget just how long the Syrian civil war has gone on for. Marie Colvin was killed in 2012 while reporting on it. The Syrian government claimed that she was attacked by terrorists, but her family never believed that. And Kat, her sister, who's a lawyer based in New York, believes the Syrian government deliberately targeted her. And last week, she and her family filed a claim against the Syrian government. In 2001, Marie herself spoke to Martha Carney here on Woman's Hour about the dangers of her work and the attack that had led to her losing the sight in her left eye.
I think if you are going to cover a war, you always weigh the risks. I mean, I had shrapnel in my eye and lost the sight in the left eye in a conflict in Sri Lanka. It was, you know, at the same time, very important for me to go. I wanted to cover the Tamil areas. There was no way to go without taking that risk. I think you weigh the risks, and sometimes it goes wrong. But, you know, you are covering conflicts where people are being killed, people are, you know, losing sons, daughters. And I think it would be very silly of any of us to say you can cover a war without risking yourself, unless you want to cover it from the press headquarters at NATO. And I don't think that's the way to cover a war.
Marie Colvin on Woman's Hour in 2001. Kat Colvin, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to talk to you. I know this, it cannot be easy reliving time and time again what happened to your sister, but you've been investigating the events of that day in February 2012. What do you think happened on that day?
Oh, it's extremely clear now, although I always suspected Marie was targeted from the early days after speaking to Paul Conroy, who was familiar with the sort of bracketing of the media center. He always believed they were targeted. I did too. It's taken years working with the CJA, who did an incredible investigation, meeting with defectors, meeting with people on the ground, getting documents that we could get smuggled out. So it's been quite a journey. But we've pulled together evidence that shows with absolutely no doubt that not only Marie, but all of the journalists were targeted as the highest priority of the military and security forces in Syria, with orders coming from the office of the president.
Precisely because of the nature of their reporting.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly, Syria is very bureaucratic, and so they documented their priorities. Number one priority in quelling this popular uprising that started in 2011 was to target the journalists who they labeled as terrorists. And it was a high priority for the government to take out the journalists first and then move on to the activists.
She died in 2012. It's now 2018. Your civil action wasn't filed until a couple of years ago, 2016. And you're a lawyer. This is clearly a difficult, intricate business, to put it mildly.
Well, listen, I would love to see Assad in prison. I'm not able to bring a criminal case. There's not a whole lot I can do. Maybe it's a little bit of lawyer's revenge, but it's the small way that I can try to bring attention to the suffering of the Syrian people and the danger of to all of us of silencing a free press in any country. You know, if the news is not getting out, we don't really know what's happening.
Is it true that the informant in your sister's case was a woman, and this in particular really shocked you?
Well, there were a network of informants, really. But the person who was able to, you know, most closest to the attack, identify exactly where Marie was a woman, yes, and that was disturbing because Marie has always been such a strong supporter and mentor to women, you know, in her profession, but also in my family, and inspiring to a lot of young women. In fact, a lot of the attorneys on this case, as I mentioned that I worked with the Center for Justice and Accountability, but my former law firm, Sherman and Sterling, staffed it with a lot of young women who were really inspired pulling this case together. So she was such a woman's woman that was a shock that she'd be betrayed in the end by a woman.
If you win, what will happen?
Well, you know, there's another entire process. It's a civil case, and so the damages are financial. My main goal was to get this evidence out there in the hopes, really, that someday it'll be used in a criminal trial. Right now, this is the tool I have, a civil case. And so I will pursue maximum damages. The way I look at it, whatever money I can squeeze out of the Syrian regime is less money they can spend on chemical weapons.
And obviously, this is something you're doing for your big sister. She was a colossal figure in your life. She was a big public figure, but to you, she was your big sister. So tell us about her.
Yeah, I still get a little emotional, really, hearing her voice.
Yes, I'm sure.
She was really central to my life. I mean, if you can imagine someone as wonderful as Marie being, you know, a part of my life since I was very young, we were extremely close. One of the hardest parts is not having Marie in my children's life. They absolutely adored her. And every vacation we took together, every minute they spent with her was a big adventure, as it was for me growing up. And I regret that she's not in their life to take them on some wild trip or adventure, just spend time with them.
It's easy, I suppose, to look at the image that we all know of Marie Colvin with the eye patch on and think there was somebody who was utterly fearless. In that clip we played from our programme, she sounds like someone who feared nobody, feared nothing. But of course, she must have had times where she felt desperately lonely and vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think that she was fearless. I think she was extremely fearful. She just overcame that fear for the larger good. Marie was an optimist, and she really believed that if she could report better or share what she was seeing in terms of the suffering of civilians and the atrocities of war, that the world would rise up and unite and somehow stop it. It's really disheartening that all these years have gone by, 7 years now, that the Syrian people are under attack by the Assad regime, and the world hasn't risen up to protect them or do anything, really.
Well, of course, some people would say that might be about to change, or at least there was some sort of action on Friday evening, early hours of Saturday. What do you make of that?
Yeah, you know, I'd say at least there's the beginning of a multinational response. I am glad that there was a response to this latest chemical attack, and, you know, that France and Britain and the U.S. Joined together in this response. But it's not that one bombing raid is going to move the needle. And this isn't the first chemical attack. I mean, by many reports, there have been dozens of chemical attacks. This one, the Syrians managed to get images out, and so we responded. But it's a much larger problem, and, you know, one day bombing raid isn't going to change the situation.
We appreciate your time for what is it. I know that it's the very early hours of the morning with you. Thank you very much indeed, Kat.
Thanks for having me.
Kat Colvin, who is the sister of the late, great Marie Colvin. And obviously full coverage of the events in the House of Commons on 5 Live and indeed here on Radio 4 throughout the day today. Now, to something much more positive. I hope you did get the chance to see England winning the Commonwealth Games gold medal in netball yesterday. It was replayed in its entirety on BBC Two at the reasonable time of 9:30, but the actual events took place in the early hours, as you're about to hear. I've been talking to Fran Connolly, Director of Development at England Netball, and I congratulated her and said, actually, this is a huge moment for netball.
I think it's really hard to appreciate just how significant this moment is if you're not from netball or don't have a sporting background. But I've heard it described as the men's football team beating Germany in a World Cup final in Germany. And that's certainly how it felt yesterday.
And the manner of that victory, the score being 52-51 with the last goal in literally as time was just trickling away, you couldn't have written a better script, could you?
Oh, you couldn't. They certainly put the fans back in England through it, those girls. It was almost an exact rerun of what we'd had the day before against Jamaica in the semi-finals. We won it in the last, well, the time had been called in that match and we won it with a penalty shot. And in the final, we won it as the clock ticked on to zero. I mean, you couldn't have written a more thrilling script.
I saw it when it was replayed as live at about 9:30 yesterday morning. But the actual match was in the wee small hours of Sunday, wasn't it?
It was. I think the diehard netball and sports fans got up for the 4 a.m. start. It was a really early one.
And where were you?
I was at home. I was watching the match. I think I woke up all the family and all the neighbours in the streets with the cheering.
Be honest, you didn't actually expect to win the final, did you?
No, if I'm really honest, we had a huge belief in this squad. They've been absolutely fantastic throughout. We've cemented a culture over time and the leadership team around them really believed in them as well. And I think for us, the gold medal, if I'm really honest, was getting to a final. We made history in getting to the final. We've never got to a Commonwealth Games final before. And the girls just proved if you get to a final, then absolutely anything can happen.
Tracy Neville, the coach, is obviously an enormous influence. What is it that she has?
She has passion. She has tremendous love for this country. And she leads in that way. She inspires those girls to really believe. She's an ex-international player herself. She knows what it feels like to take that court. And she knows what it feels like to come so close and not win. And she didn't want that for this squad. She wanted them to be leaders and she wanted them to win the medals that they deserved. And she drove the squad forward with that manner and with that passion.
It's made for some fantastic coverage for the sport and some wonderful images on the front pages of the newspapers today, which I'm all over Twitter as well and social media generally yesterday. How do you move on from this, Fran, and make the most of it?
It's absolutely gone crazy here. You're right. It's netball fever has gripped the nation and long may it continue. And our plan, we're really lucky actually, because like many legacy projects don't have that next big moment to keep the momentum up. And we're so lucky that we've got a World Cup on home turf next year in Liverpool in July. So today we go on sale with fan packages for that. So we can keep the momentum up. We can keep talking about netball. But really what we want to do is we want to make sure that those people that we've inspired that are not currently part of the sport, they head to our website, they check out the session finder, because there's so many different forms of netball. It might have seemed a bit fast paced and fierce on the international court, which it absolutely is. But we have back to netball, we have walking netball, we have netball at various different paces and various different forms. So whether you're a young girl, a mum or a grandma that's been inspired by the tournament, then there should be a form of netball that works for you.
Yeah, it's about getting the sport out of school and into women's everyday lives, isn't it? What I couldn't help but notice was that when I played netball, I was a centre because that was the position that, as 5'1" Jane, I was equipped for. The whole team looked about 5'9", 5'10", and taller yesterday.
Yeah, they are. And it's quite typical for netballers on international stages to be 6 foot plus. And thankfully, at grassroots level, that doesn't really matter. You can be a phenomenal goal shooter or an incredible goalkeeper and not have that height. And certainly in things like our back to netball, our netball now, you can play in whatever position works for you. It's far more about the enjoyment, the social and the mental well-being and benefits that you receive from the sport.
That is Fran Connolly, who is head of development at England Netball. And our congratulations to England, who just triumphed in such great style yesterday. If you haven't caught up with it, I'm sure it's still available. It was an amazing victory over Australia. And that is the entire reason that we booked Kathleen Turner for this morning's show, because she is very interested in this sort of thing, because she has represented young England at volleyball.
I did. I was here going to high school at the American School in London in St. John's Wood. And my final year, my senior year, I was captain of the team that we won. I think the final playoffs were in Frankfurt, I recall.
Yes.
And it was quite exciting.
Did you beat the Germans? Because that would have been amazing.
I don't think so. I think they were Belgians.
Oh, right. That slightly ruins the story. Yeah. It's not quite as good. But nevertheless, we'll take it. What a wonderful coincidence that you're with us this morning.
Yeah.
I'm going to plough through the introduction in case people don't know who you are.
All right.
It's always possible. Has starred in films, of course, like Body Heat, Romancing the Stone. She was the voice of Jessica Rabbit. She's been in Friends, performed as Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate. And she's in London for the next couple of weeks. And then she's going around the country to places like Worthing, Colchester, Edinburgh, in a one-woman cabaret-style show called Finding My Voice. Now, this is you chatting and then occasionally bursting into song.
Well, I tell stories, which I love to do. And the stories sort of lend themselves into a song. I work with these two wonderful men, Andy Gale and Mark Janis. And Andy has all of musical literature in his head, I swear. So I would, you know, as usual, tell a story of some kind, something that popped into mind, and he'd say, oh, that's, you know, that reminds me of this song. And then Mark, the pianist, the arranger, would say, oh, I don't know how that should sound. And so we kept finding songs that we all loved and the stories that prompted them.
The titles of some of the songs you're going to sing then?
Oh, just to tease, I suppose. I do at the early on sing Let's Fall in Love in my flirtatious manner, I hope. But I sing songs about the work, and part of that is Paper Moon.
Oh, yeah.
And creating a world and making you believe in it. And one of the songs is how hard it is being on the road and how much you miss. And there's a song called Sweet Kentucky Ham. That's about being
ham.
On the road.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought it was going to be about ham.
Yeah, well, you miss the ham, but yeah. It's not actually in a description of a person, no.
Well, you've worked with some hams over the years, haven't you?
Well, yes, a few.
I could be writing your script, actually. You lived in England for quite a while, as you've just described, as an adolescent. So being in London can't be all that strange to you.
No, I've spent a lot of time here. Several shows on the West End. The BBC has brought me over for radio dramas.
Yeah, it has, and, absolutely.
I did a season at the Chichester Festival Theatre one summer, which was really, really rather enchanting. I enjoyed that. So I feel as though I'm here a great deal.
Yeah, well, we're always very glad to see you, obviously. Over the years, you have worked with some of the biggest names, and I dare to suggest some of the most awkward individuals in Hollywood. Of all, let's just be honest, I want to know about your male co-stars.
Oh, okay.
Well, because people are interested. Who was the most irritating and who was the most talented, genuinely?
Oh, well, I am very thankful in that I have always gotten along extremely well with people, with one exception.
And that was that Burt Reynolds?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, I understand that he's recently surfaced with some bad talk about me again, which this happened 30 years ago, this film. Really, you know, let it go, honey.
What was the film?
It was called Switching Channels. And I was supposed to do it with Michael Caine and had rehearsed with him. But Michael was doing Jaws 4 and the shark kept breaking down. And so finally the producer had to recast.
Right. Why did Michael Caine do Jaws 4? But anyway, that's an interview another
day.
Well,
you know why.
Yes, I can guess. Yeah. So Burt stepped in and were things bad right from the start?
Right from the start. I remember the very first day I left the room crying. You know, I called my husband and I said, I don't think I can do this. And he said, you know, just don't let him know he got to you like that. Go back in. But other than that, I've had wonderful relationships with Michael and Danny DeVito, because it was always the three of us, Michael Douglas,
yes,
Danny DeVito and me.
Yeah.
We feel like quite a gang.
And you were sort of undeniably flirty, certainly with Michael Douglas.
Oh, in Romancing the Stone, yes, I was. But I understood he was separated. And then that became clear that was not really true. So that was the end of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're still friends?
All the time. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, oh, yeah.
I just checking up.
I just got an email from Danny today. His daughter is having her first art exhibit. One of his daughters, anyway.
Oh, well, that's lovely. So it's lovely to think you just casually open your email inbox and there's Danny DeVito who's been in touch with somebody. That's actually rather, makes me feel rather warm, warm inside. So you mentioned your husband. I know you're no longer with him, but he was someone that you'd said that you didn't like Harvey Weinstein. You'd said that to your husband.
And oh, God, yes.
Because you didn't like him right from the get-go.
Never. The only way I could conceivably think of women being with him was either that he paid a great deal of money or had some kind of power. I was fortunate in that Body Heat being my first role, was a starring role, in fact.
So you weren't vulnerable.
Yes, I wasn't someone looking for that breakthrough. So in that sense, I was protected from anything. But more than that, I knew from right from the beginning, truly, that the culture toward women in Los Angeles was so contemptuous. And I felt so uncomfortable there that I had decided right at the beginning I would never try and make a home there. I would get on the first flight back to New York.
And you kept on doing that?
Always. And, of course, they warned me back in those days that it would have an effect on the career. But in truth, it would have had a worse effect on me to try and live there.
Yeah, I know you've said that you don't like playing victims or you'd never play a victim.
I don't. I mean, the woman may fail, but she has to try.
Yeah, okay. And she can't be at the mercy of...
She can't be someone who is saved by a man or something. I mean, it's very simple. If you read a script and if you took the woman's character out and the story did not change, then that's not for me.
Which of your films now would you look back on and say, oh, I'd pay to see that now?
Oh, I think Accidental Tourist. I think that was a wonderful, again, Larry Kasdan and Bill Hurt and Gina Davis. But it was, and I love Ann Taylor's books, her writing.
Sure.
And this is the only one she's ever allowed to be made
to be filmed.
Into a film.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the one you're most proud of.
In
right.
very many ways, yes.
And when Helen Mirren has just said she thinks that Netflix is killing off the movies, do you worry about that?
I don't know. I see, on the other hand, I see some really exciting new material coming out of the cable stations. And what I see coming out in theaters are spin-offs, endless cartoons, endless destruction. How many cars can you blow up? How many people can you shoot?
Dwayne The Rock Johnson,
he
makes
money.
I think
the film is killing itself because it's so formulaic, it's so predictable.
Yeah, if there was more Accidental Tourist, there'd be more discerning people at the cinema.
Ah, those people are gone.
They're not, though, are they?
No,
they're watching Netflix.
The cable. Yes.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I mean, your career was stopped in its tracks, really, by your diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm physically stopped in my tracks. Yeah,
yeah, that. I mean, I think back in the day, that felt like not quite. It was gloomy news, to put it mildly. But you're still there. You're still performing.
Oh gosh, no, more than ever. It was new medications and a lot of hard work, to get my body back. But if I can't move, I can't act, and I do love acting.
At one point, I think you were told that you'd never walk again.
Oh, they said I would be in a wheelchair the rest of my life, and I told them they were fired.
Yeah, I truly. Would love to see your show because I think there must be some amazing anecdotes. You've given us just a flavour today. We're really grateful. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
It's a pleasure.
That's Kathleen Turner, whose show is at a venue called The Other Palace, and it's until the 6th of May, and she's doing her cabaret and singing and just strolling gently down Anecdote Avenue. Probably not that gently, actually. Kathleen, lovely to meet you. Thank you very much.
And you.
Now, on social media, in theory at least, you sort of decide yourself who you are and who you're going to be, but but sometimes the whole thing can get a bit too much. For Nia Petit, her online profile was all about her hair. As part of a natural hair movement for women of colour, she became popular for her big, curly head of hair. But then she began to feel that actually her afro was the only thing she had. So she cut the whole thing off. The comedian Bella Younger had a big online following for her alter ego, Deliciously Stella. You might recall she was interviewed by me on this programme about exactly that. It's a parody of clean eating and wellness bloggers. But Bella started to find it all too much as well and had to take a break after it all just became too overwhelming. I've been talking to them both, and here is Nia first.
Hair has always been such a statement, especially for women of colour, to express themselves, their power, their culture. And for me, hair did start as that, but then it became a sense of validation from people's comments online and people's likes. And I just really wanted to get to know Nia again, so I decided to cut it all off.
Because Nia had essentially become her hair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And nothing else.
Nothing else. That's all I knew. Everywhere I went, I had to have my hair big with my fringe in front of my face. Every picture I took, I had to have my hair out. And I wouldn't even go swimming when I was traveling because I would mess up my hair. It was just a really horrible addiction that I had.
And your hair grew and grew.
Yes. And went blonde, big. It did everything.
Well, your job became to maintain your hair.
Yeah.
To show your hair, mm-hmm. to change it and tweak it. And how many different videos did you make about
it? Many. And on YouTube, maybe like 150. Then on Instagram, at least 3 a week of just me picking my hair with an afro pick or showing how to detangle it, how to style it. It was just really unhealthy, the obsession I had with it. I'd spend at least about 3 hours when I'd wash it, so twice a week, on my hair.
So Bella, listening to that, your experience is very different because your online presence is of a funny woman in a very different way. That is hard to maintain too. Your thing was called Deliciously Stella.
Yeah, so I play a character on my Instagram. It was a satirical spoof of the clean eating phenomenon. Mm. So I would take gym selfies, but instead of just being in my gym kit, I'd have crunchies strapped to my abs to say that I was doing crunches.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'd strap fabs to my stomach to have fab abs. So it was all very, very silly and really fun. But, you know, it got so, so popular that I ended up doing it for a very, very long time. I sort of took a bit of a step back and I started doing it every few days. But there was still a huge amount of pressure to continue to post and to keep people engaged. And the pressure really got to me.
Were you aware that some people who were looking at your stuff didn't put any distance between Stella and Bella?
Absolutely. That's something that became one of the main problems. People would come up to me and they'd go, oh, are you Deliciously Stella? And they were like, oh, do you really eat all that stuff on your account? Or, you know, I'd be in a restaurant and people would be like, oh, obviously you're getting a pudding. And I was like, no, I'm actually not the same. Like, I created her and, you know, I do like food and I think we should be able to eat whatever we want. But I don't always want a WKD.
Yeah.
Not always.
I do actually eat rocket.
And
the occasional tomato.
Mm.
And it began to really seriously trouble you. This isn't a trifling matter, actually, is it? This is something that really began to affect your well-being.
Yeah, no, it really did. I'd struggle with my mental health for a while and I went viral on BuzzFeed and overnight I got, you know, 100,000 followers. Mm. And suddenly I was just like, so many people are watching me make these jokes and people are so quick to tell you whether or not something is funny. And I started to place my whole value on whether people were liking my photos or not. And it landed me in hospital because I was so, so stressed.
Well, Nia was nodding, but you seem quite... Well, I don't blame you for being shocked that Bella ended up in hospital.
Yeah, but I can relate to just feeling like likes determine your worth. It was it's a really unhealthy obsession that we have, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's like a slow process, and then you realize you're in it when you're like, oh, we didn't get this many likes, and then you're sad and you're like zooming in to find your flaws. And then I would wake up at 2 a.m and just scroll and everyone's comments and see what this person said and what that person said. It was terrible.
Bella?
I had a repetitive strain injury in my thumb from scrolling.
Right. Are you all right now, Bella, by the way?
Oh, I'm very fine now, but it took a long time. It didn't sort of...
I didn't sort of go away and get better very, very quickly. You know, it was a really, really long process, and sort of learning not to care what other people think so much, and realizing that I'm worth so much more than one character that I created or my presence on social media. But I've realized that I'm actually not ever really going to be able to take a selfie and not feel weird about it.
What do you
so
mean?
I thought I would stop doing Deliciously Stella, and then I would just do Instagram as Bella Younger. But I'm finding it quite hard. I'm finding it quite hard to think about what sort of, you know, what part of myself I want to actually put out there. And I'm sort of thinking that maybe there isn't a part of me that belongs online.
Well, why should any part of you belong online?
In a modern world, having a social media presence opens a lot of doors. And, you know, I want to write scripts and... Yeah. You know, articles and all that sort of thing, and people will look at the audience that you have online, and it makes you more employable.
That's the brutal reality of the modern
workplace. The brutal reality of it is that people expect you to have a social media presence these days.
And your social media presence already existed, and you were funny woman.
Mm. If someone were to give me a TV show commission, they will use my social media presence as collateral because I have a built-in audience.
Yeah.
And if I just turn away from that audience and I, you know, let it all go, I'm a much less attractive prospect, you know, when it comes to commissioning a sitcom or even asking me to write an article in the newspaper.
The thing is, I suppose, that people want you to be the person they thought you were.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And people just still want to ask me about food. And, you know, I've got lots to say about food, but I've also got lots to say about other things. And I realised that I had to stop Deliciously Stella if I was ever going to concentrate on anything else properly, because it was sort of holding me back.
It's interesting, Nia, that you appear to have been able to break away from the big hair thing to do other stuff. Bella seems to be finding it harder to do.
It is a tricky one, but even after I did cut my hair, I still had people asking why I cut it. Do I plan to grow it back again? I miss your hair. I heard it all. But I just had to stop talking about hair, and that's the only way I could escape. I've changed the direction of what I speak about. So cutting my hair allowed me to speak in my truth, where I share positivity on back knee or stretch marks. So I was on Times Square with my back knee for a brand called Airy.
You'll have to push that one past me again. Sorry. You were on Times Square in New York.
Yes.
With your back knee.
Yeah, on the billboards.
Got you. Okay, so you did a whole campaign for...
body positivity and skin and just being natural. So I also made the effort to not Photoshop my images anymore and just to share the real me. And I'm also in school doing journalism, so I want to focus on that as well.
Is there a gender side to this? Are we more at ease with men being all sorts of different things? You know, the word polymath is often associated, can be associated with women, but you do hear it more widely associated with men. What do you think about that?
Social media influencing in general is something that women have taken to much, much more than men.
Well, we are the shoppers and the buyers, aren't we?
Exactly. And I think, you know, we traditionally have more interest in the worlds of fashion and healthy eating and all that sort of stuff. So I guess it is something that's definitely affected women more than men.
But do you think that you should be freer than you appear to be to change direction?
I would love to be freer to change direction, but I think I am definitely responsible for painting myself into a corner. You know, I wasn't out there being like, I don't want to talk about food anymore. I was just talking about food more. And that's because I knew that talking about the things that people wanted me to talk about would get me more engagement, more followers, and, you know, ultimately more money. So I played into it.
You sound as though you're giving yourself quite a hard time.
Maybe.
Yes, that's a traditional female trait, I guess. Mm. So the future for you both, then, is what exactly? Nia, if you could sum up your ambition for the next couple of years, what would it be?
I really want to open charities, especially in Africa, and just empower young girls, whether that's even working with sanitary towel companies to allow them to go to school every day of the month. And also helping young girls in the UK to empower them to chase their dreams, to focus on school, just so that they don't feel like they have to meet society's expectations of beauty.
And Bella?
I would just love to continue making people laugh, but not necessarily with Deliciously Stella.
Bella Younger and Nia Petit on their social media lives. Now, Keeping Faith is a drama series. It's set in Wales and it stars Eve Miles as Faith Howells, whose life is turned upside down when her husband Evan disappears. Now, the series first broadcast on S4C in Welsh and it's now proved a record breaker on the BBC iPlayer. Here's a really brief clip. Faith's on the phone to her brother-in-law, a local policeman.
Terry, it's Faith.
Oh, hiya, love. You're not going to let me down about this quiz night now, are you? We're banking on you.
I will be there. Listen, I've lost Evan.
You what?
Well, he went to work this morning and never arrived. Thing is, he's missed a really important appointment.
I'm sure he'll turn up.
Are you speaking as a police officer or as his brother-in-law?
He usually has lunch with Beth on nights, do we, Trader? Faith?
Yes?
I'm sure there's a perfectly rational explanation. He'll have been caught up with a client or something.
Yeah.
Eve Miles as Faith Howells. Eve's in our studio in Cardiff. Good morning to you. How are you?
Hi, Jane. I'm very good, thank you. I'm excited and a little bit nervous.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. I mean, the excitement is fine. Nerves, I don't allow. So, first of all, this is it's a series that is basically about small-town skullduggery and who knows what about what everybody else is up to. It is gripping. How did it all start and why are people only finding out about it through word of mouth now?
Well, it's a project that's been worked on over the last 5 years, and it came to me about 4.5 years ago. And Pip Broughton, who is the producer and the director of the piece, sent me an email one morning and said, "I've been working on this. I would love you to have a little look at Faith Howells because I'd love you to play this part." And, of course, it was an S4C BBC One Wales production. And the part of Faith Howells is, goodness me, every actor's dream, really, especially mine. She's just the most, it's just the most incredible story.
Well, she's in almost every scene, isn't she, if not every scene?
Yes, she is. Yeah, it's relentless. She kind of, the audience sees the story through Faith's eyes and experiences everything that Faith does through the 8 hours of the drama.
Yeah.
And I was, very... very ready at that point in my career for something like this, for a change. And
except that you didn't speak Welsh.
Except I didn't speak Welsh. So it's, on one hand, I was given the most incredible opportunity of my career so far. And on the other hand, it was, but you can only do it in a different language.
So, quite simply, you learnt Welsh.
So, quite simply, I thought, well, you know what? I'm ready for a challenge. And there's no bigger challenge than learning that beautiful language. And that's what I did. I sat down, learnt it so that I could play Faith Howells. Something like that comes along, Jane, and you've got to do whatever you can to turn up on that set on the first day and play that character.
Well, there is much that is brilliant about Keeping Faith. I should say I'm on episode 7 8. So I don't want any spoilers from you about what actually happens
okay,
at the end.
Okay, I promise.
But there, can I just make some really obvious... there's some cracking bits about this that are different. First of all, yes, you're Yellow Mac. I like a lot of your clothes. I think a lot of women will probably enjoy the clothes. Scenery is marvellous. Beautiful, yes. Carmarthenshire and other parts of Wales.
Yes.
Also, you have 3 children. Your character has 3 children and they are actually in the story, including the baby,
yes,
who isn't just conveniently asleep but has to be carted around.
That's right.
Why is that so rare in television drama?
Because we have the most magnificent director called Pip Broughton, and she insisted on this story being hyper-realistic.
Yeah.
We've gone for hyper-realism with everything. You see the creases and the wrinkles and the everything that you don't normally see in a drama, you get in Keeping Faith. And I think that's what connects the audience so strongly with it, is that we can recognise ourselves in this story. You know, you've got Faith crashing out of the house with a missing husband, with a baby on a hip, 6 or 7 bags to get the kids to swimming on time whilst eating a banana.
Yeah.
I mean, it was no easy feat, Jane, let's be honest.
No, and also you keep your heels on, which I hugely admire.
Well, the whole heel thing has been hilarious because Faith has been on maternity leave for a while. And of course, she walks around when she's barefoot. She's quite, you know, at one with you know, just being comfortable, you know. Yeah. And as a lawyer, she's always suited and booted, and it's the side of her job she can't stand, really. It's been restricted. So Pip and I worked out that at any given point she'd kick those heels off, which we all do when we get in from work. We kick our heels off and we get in pyjamas, or that might just be me. But, you know, we just wanted to keep everything as real as possible. And I think through the series with the baby and the children, you can almost smell those children coming through the screen. It's so personal, and we just wanted it to be the viewer looking in on our lives.
Yeah, I didn't mention the interior design of the house and the scented candles and all that stuff you've got going on. Is it women are liking this because it was made for women? I mean, was that the way you and Pip were thinking about this show?
No, we didn't want to discriminate against anybody. We wanted to tell a really good story. We wanted to serve Matthew Hall's incredible script, give it all the justice it deserved. And we wanted to share it with everybody and to keep it as personal and as intimate as possible.
I get that. But I mean, again, here's proof that if you put women front and centre of a drama, guess what? Women will watch it in their droves. Here's a tweet from Maggie. Discovered Keeping Faith yesterday. I watched the whole lot until 4 o'clock this morning.
Oh, my.
Come on, Maggie. I don't know whether to be impressed or not.
Oh, well done, Maggie. I'm going to take you out for a pint.
Oh, well, that's nice for Maggie, but I don't see any offer of a drink for me.
So you're saying,
are you now fluent in Welsh?
Well, what is lovely is that I can stand in any queue in Wales, and I can be a part of somebody's argument now that is having an argument in Welsh, and I can just sneakily be a part of it because I know what they're now saying.
That in itself is well worth the effort.
Yeah, I mean, the response, the social media response, because of course, when you asked earlier, why is it only on iPlayer, we can see it, is because it was, you know, it was a BBC Wales production and S4C production, so it was only... It was made for Wales, and then on the iPlayer, it's just taken on a life of its own.
And I should say that on the iPlayer, it is in English, so you can watch it if you don't speak Welsh.
It is, yes.
Say goodbye in Welsh then, please.
Oh, hwyl, hwyl fawr.
Yes, bore da.
Good morning to you too.
There
you
are. That'll do. It's better than nothing.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, what a superb bit of Welsh there from me. It's the Scouse, you see. It basically gives us an ability to communicate in almost all languages. It's quite superb. Okay, that was, I think probably it's fair to say, she was the star of today's show. Judging by reaction, everybody loves Keeping Faith. Everyone loves Eve Miles. And my attention was drawn to Keeping Faith, first of all, by my best friend, who said to me, oh, you've got to watch Keeping Faith. I don't want to name her because she'll get above herself. And also by a Woman's Hour listener called Sally Macnus. Now, Sally is an artist. I think she's Welsh, but she lives in Dorset. And she just kept tweeting saying, have you seen Keeping Faith? Why don't you put it on Woman's Hour? So, Sally, I know that Eve thanked you as well. So I'd like to thank you for a lot of iPlayer enjoyment I've had over the last week or two, keeping up with Keeping Faith and... almost watched the whole thing. I was going to watch episode 8 last night, but then for some reason the kids wanted to watch Jack Whitehall. I have no idea why. But I finally will get to the end of Keeping Faith tonight, I think. Now, why is it so good? Honestly, it's partly because the scenery is brilliant. And if you don't know Wales, then you will absolutely want to go to Wales after seeing this. But genuinely because the baby isn't just at grandma's or conveniently asleep when the action takes place, but is carted about and is involved and is part of the unfurling plot. I think it's actually a bit of a game changer in terms of TV shows. I will never watch a TV show featuring an alleged baby again without expecting the baby to be involved in what's going on. That's what's so brilliant about it. Keeping Faith is fantastic drama, says this listener. What an ending. What now for them? Well, I haven't seen the ending. Sue, just to let you know that Keeping Faith has been on national television, BBC Wales. So it is not right to say it hasn't been on national television. OK, I absolutely take your point, Sue. It has been on national BBC One Wales. Rachel, one of a number of people who absolutely loved Kathleen Turner. And sometimes I sit here and I cannot believe my luck that sitting opposite me in the flesh is someone like Kathleen Turner. And I could have talked to her for at least the entire entire day. I think people probably would have kept listening because that woman has lived a life and she's met loads and loads of different people. She told me a very entertaining story, actually, about life in LA. This is before we went on air. Well, she said that she'd once been at a dinner party with a load of Hollywood types, and one woman said that she'd just got back from making a documentary about and with the Dalai Lama. But nobody else apart from Kathleen Turner around the table expressed any interest because the Dalai Lama wasn't really a big name in Hollywood, which I think gives you some indication that it's quite an insular world, which is why Kathleen has always kept her home in New York and never wants to live in LA. Anyway, Rachel says Kathleen Turner on Woman's Hour saying she doesn't play victims. The woman can fail, but she has to try. I absolutely love this, says Rachel. Yes, absolutely right. Will emailed to say, I love the way Kathleen had to be introduced in case some listeners hadn't heard of her. Well, yeah, I only did that because sometimes people need a little jog, don't they, first thing in the morning. I think the vast majority of our audience will have heard of her. But when I interviewed Hillary Clinton, I was given a suggested script to introduce her, just in case anybody wasn't sure who it was. So you do, you know, you've got to watch these things. You can't assume every bit of knowledge. Anyway, Will goes on. One of the biggest stars of the 80s, a wonderful actress. I remember watching her in the cinema as a 16-year-old in 1990. It was The War of the Roses, co-starring Michael Douglas and Danny DeVito. Where did 30-odd years go? Great woman. Yes, I mean, I'm continually thinking these days, where did 30-odd years go? Now, tomorrow, we're going to be talking, amongst other things, about an intriguing new novel, which I've read. It's called Our House. It's by Louise Candlish. And it starts with a woman coming back home to discover that people are moving in to her house. It's been sold and she knew nothing about it. And if you think that's a bad place to be, it just gets worse and worse and worse. So Louise Candlish, who is the author of Our House, which will terrify most of you, is on the programme tomorrow. She says, I think, that she wanted to write a book that was Gone Girl for property lovers. That was effectively it. And she has done it because it really is deeply unnerving. So Louise on the programme tomorrow. Other things you can look forward to during the course of the week. Well, Jenny, I've noticed, has copped for the press night of Tina Turner the Musical, which is tomorrow night. I'm not going to see that, but that's Jenny's got to go because she's interviewing the director, Phyllida Lloyd, which will be on Thursday of this week. Also, the band Stealing Sheep are on the programme on Thursday. And I'm back on Friday. And we're going to be discussing, amongst other things, a brilliant project that you might recall from a number of years ago, the Pause Project in Hackney in East London, which is all about working to help women who've had children and then lost them to the care system keep their children, get their children back in some cases. It's really, really interesting stuff. And that's going to be on the programme on Friday. Thanks for listening to the podcast today. Have a good week and keep in touch with Woman's Hour.